Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, April 2nd, and we are continuing a public hearing on House Bill 5021, which is the budget bill for the Department of Higher Education. Open a public hearing on House Bill 5021, and first off, Mr. Bender from Legislative Fiscal has some additional information for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This morning, you will be hearing the second day of the public hearing on the Department of Higher Education, and the focus of today's discussion will be the governor's budget, what the governor is proposing for this upcoming biennium, and a look at the revenue sources that will be supporting that budget, primarily general fund and tuition. Those will be the revenue sources that most of the presentation will be focusing on. If I may, in order to set the stage for this today's meeting, I would like to point out that I've distributed a number of items to you this morning that you should see in front of you. And Mr. McGee from Department of Administrative Services has distributed a copy of the governor's budget presentation, which will be immediately following my brief introduction. But the materials that I distributed to you are basically twofold. The first is you will see a letter from the chancellor to the co-chairs dated March 25th. This is a request for other funds expenditure limitation increase, a supplemental limitation increase for the 01-03 biennium. So that's the biennium that will be ending on June 30th of this year. Functionally and as a process, this is considered, as far as the committee is concerned, a separate request because it's not part of the 03-05 budget. And I also need to tell you that functionally, as the way the committee process is set up by the co-chairs, is that the subcommittee doesn't really have possession of this request until the co-chairs sign off on it. And they have not done so, not because they have problems with it or they're still thinking about it. They haven't done so because I haven't been able to even talk to them about this yet. I hope to be able to do that today. So technically, this isn't even in your possession yet. The reason why I'm distributing it to you now is this is the day of the discussion where the types of issues relating to this request are going to be discussed. And I just wanted to let you know that the basis of their request is they are requesting about $12.8 million in an expenditure limitation increase for tuition revenue expenses for program services and another $1.4 million to provide fee remissions for the current biennium. The other item that I have handed out to you this morning is a chart that is in color and is labeled funding change from 2001 session levels. This, by the way, is, I handed out a chart like this yesterday, which we didn't get to discuss. If you have that earlier chart, please dispose of it, because I did make one small change overnight, and I'd like there. I had left out $4 million appropriation that went to the e-board last session, so I put that in, so these numbers are now more accurate. But if I could just spend a few minutes, Madam Chair, to discuss what this chart is showing. And I think everyone sees it and sees which one I'm talking about here. It's the one that's dated 4203. The blue in this chart identifies the change in state support dollars, that's to say general fund and lottery fund dollars, compared to the amount that was approved during the 2001 regular session, that is to say before the special session reductions and before the governor's allotment reductions. And it compares that number, which you approved in 2001, to the number that the governor is now proposing in 2003. And if you look at the very leftmost bar there, you can see that the dollar amount is actually down. The proposed budget, the proposed funding in general and state support for higher ed is 6.2% less than that which was approved 2 years ago. The other areas there refer to the main areas where general fund is being provided in this particular budget. You may recall that other diagram you looked at yesterday that showed the various program areas, education in general, and had all those little pie charts in them. Education in general, which is the biggest portion of general fund, that is down actually 6.5% from the amount that was available 2 years ago. And the other three, what those acronyms stand for, AES is the Agricultural Experiment Station, ES is the Extension Service, and FRL is the Forest Research Laboratory. Those are the three statewide public service programs of Oregon State University, and all of those funding amounts are down as well. So this, of course, creates difficulties, clearly, for the institutions in dealing with a declining amount of general fund support at a time when enrollments are increasing and other costs in general are going up. I did distribute an item to you yesterday that I don't know, I have extra copies in case you don't have those with you, but it was, we didn't get to it yesterday, it was a chart that showed what was happening to enrollment at the Oregon University system, and if any of you don't have that, please let me know, because I have brought copies. If you look to see what's happening with enrollment, you can see that enrollment is growing very rapidly at this particular point in time. We're talking about enrollment growth of, you know, in the range of 6% each year, which is a, you know, a very vigorous rate of growth. The year that we're in right now, in this particular chart, is the one labeled 2002, because even though it's now 2003, these are the enrollment counts as of the fall term. So the last fall term for this academic year was back in 2002. And then you can see projections for continued growth over the next, the biennium that you're budgeting for and the biennium after that. So the general fund is going down as the enrollment is increasing. But if we switch back to the bar chart that we were looking at earlier, the one that is in color, you can see that the red, what the red is showing, is it's showing the change not in general fund alone, but in the general fund plus the other funds limited. These are the dollars that are combined with general fund to support the operating costs of these various program areas. So, for example, actually for the OUS one overall, that probably makes the least amount of sense, given the way the budgets operate, to look at the combination of the two. But when you look at the individual program areas for education in general, you can see that when you take the state general fund and you include the tuition, the student fees, plus some of those other limited general fund, limited other fund revenues we talked about yesterday, such as the indirect cost recovery, the sales and services income, if you look at all of this, both in the old charts from yesterday, this is the red and the blue combined, but here it's just shown in red, the total amount of dollars that's available in ENG is 8% higher in the governor's recommended budget proposal compared to what it was when you during the 2001 regular session.
If I might just ask a question for personal clarification, Mr. Bender. So what you're telling us here is that the funding that's in the red column is all funding besides general fund and lottery fund that's actually available to provide academic services to students.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that question to clarify. That's not exactly what this is representing. That is the other funds and the general fund combined. So it's actually the general fund plus the tuition. If you took the general fund dollars plus the tuition dollars plus the fee dollars plus these other less significant revenue sources together, it's the total amount of funds that are available when campuses and the chancellor's office go to budget their operations.
And one further clarification. Excluded from this graph entirely are the monies that go towards research projects, the grants, and those kinds of things that are not directly involved in instructional and service provision to students.
Correct. The non-limited funds, the research grants themselves, are excluded, though. certain funds that come in for, with the grants are included here.
Thank you.
The reason for the...
One moment. Senator Meserle has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to the enrollment. Does that include community colleges as well as higher ed?
No. These are the higher ed institutions.
So could we have a graph that shows that on
Yes. I do recall that question from yesterday. I apologize. I'm not able to get that overnight, but I will get that to you. The reason for this growth is twofold. One of the reasons goes back to when you look at the enrollments, more students means more tuition dollars. So that's bringing in more tuition dollars. So as you have more students, you have more costs, but you also have more revenue. And if you look at the back, if you flip over the chart, you can see that another source of the increase in tuition revenues is the increase in the tuition charge itself. This is a time series of tuition and mandatory enrollment fees. You'll not see these same numbers from higher ed exactly, because this is sort of it's kind of a made-up number in the sense that what I've done here is I've taken the seven institutions, looked at their tuition and enrollment fees, and just did a simple average of the seven. So even though U of O has many more students than, say, Western, for this purpose, they're both institutions are counted equally in determining what the average is. Mm. What you can see here is if you compare 2002-03 with the prior year, so 2002-03 is the current school year, you can see that the tuition and mandatory enrollment fees, and these are for Oregon resident undergraduate students. The fees vary, of course, for non-residents, they're much higher, and for graduate students, they tend to be higher. This is the tuition history, and you can see that although there was a very moderate increase, or fairly moderate increase, for a period of time when the state was holding tuition rates down, this has now changed, and tuition rates are increasing. If you compare the number 4306 with the number 3759, that's this last year, that's a 14.5% increase. Also note that the 4306 is not what students actually paid this year, because unlike all the other years, in this past year, the tuition changed in the middle of the year. Typically, the tuition rate held throughout the entire academic year. In 2002-03, the tuition rate increased after Measure 28 was not approved by voters. So this is actually, the 4306 is what was actually charged only for the spring terms at the institution. They paid less this year at the fall and the winter terms. So on a year-to-year, for the full year basis, the increase was not 14.5%. It's just comparing what's being paid this spring with what was paid last spring.
And, Madam Chair, again,
Senator Bartley,
for clarification, that's an average.
Correct.
Thank you.
But again, for clarification, Mr. Bender, this isn't a weighted average. This is just an average over the university.
It is. I could do a weighted average. A weighted average would be a higher number, because the bigger institutions tend to have higher tuition rates than the smaller institutions. And it would be higher in all years, not just this last year.
Thank you.
Going back to the chart with the colored bars on them, again, you heard discussions about yesterday about access, about affordability, about quality. I think in terms of this chart, the blue shows what's happening. Well, the red, because that includes all the funds available, is basically showing the ability of the institutions to provide quality and to provide access, because that's the total dollars they have available to pay for the services that are required in higher ed. The blue, more or less, is talking about the affordability, because if the total amount of dollars are going up by 8%, even though the state dollars are going down by 6%, clearly the dollars that are coming from those other sources are going up by even more than 8%, and that's causing affordability problems. Very briefly, just to go through the other ones, you can see the agricultural experiment station Extension Service and Forest Research Laboratory. I do want to note, if I can ask you to make a couple of notations on this chart here. For the Extension Service, you see there's an 8.6% increase in all of their funds. This is the amount that's in the governor's budget, but you will be hearing that there's going to be a technical adjustment to this Extension Service. They really don't have all of the other funds that originally we thought they did. So the actual increase that's going to be presented to you will be 4.5% instead of the 8.6%. They're going to be requesting that you take out $2.5 million, which isn't really there in the budget. The other item is...
Question, Madam Chair.
And just before I take your question, Senator Misery, just for clarification, we will be dealing with the statewides at the end of next week.
I just wanted to see that. What are the other funds for Extension Service?
Extension Service has a number of other funds. It used to be, and perhaps still is, the complete name is the Cooperative Extension Service. They receive funds from the state, from the federal government, and from counties. And part of the reason for this increase is that during this current biennium, after the 2001 session was over, the legislature realized that the counties were contributing more money than had been anticipated and made adjustments for that purpose. So this may, in fact, tend to overstate the real situation for the Extension Service, because the true county contributions weren't approved actually in the 2001 session. We didn't really know back then that the counties had increased the amount of funds that they were providing. But those are the three sources: state, federal, and county funds. And some of the county services are in kind as well. The final thing I'd like to say is that the governor put his budget together, in the fall. And at that time, the governor's budget does approve certain tuition increases, which Mr. McGee will be telling you about in some detail, as well as the presentation by OUS. This was done, though, before Measure 28 was voted on. That was in January. And the governor based his recommendations on the tuition rates that existed before Measure 28 was up for a vote. I mean, they, of course, didn't know what would happen in terms of the vote. Because the tuition rates increased after the governor's recommendation, we will note that what is in the governor's budget now does not allow for the expenditure of all the tuition that we would now expect at the current rates with the surcharges. So that's if the 4306 is continued now for a full year. The governor's budget would not allow all those funds to be spent. Higher Ed is working on a calculation of what adjustments need to be made for that. Those are not available yet, but a preliminary number they gave us was that it would require an additional $91.3 million increase beyond what's in the governor's budget in order to allow those to be spent. And if that number does indeed prove to be the correct number, then if you go back to this chart and look at the education in general, the blue would stay the same. It would still be minus 6.5. But the red, instead of being plus 8%, with that extra $91 million, would be a plus 14.8% there.
So again, Mr. Bender, for personal clarification, the increased spending limitation for the $91.3 million is in addition to the expenditure increase that is addressed in the letter to the co-chairs?
Correct. That letter to the co-chairs is for 2001-03, and the roughly $90 million figure would be for 2003-05.
Thank you. Further questions or comments for Mr. Bender? Have you completed the overview of the information?
I believe so. I do want to note that in Senate Bill 430, well, The Board of Higher Education has approved a request that tuition revenue, that tuition expenditures not be limited by the legislature. And this, if you choose to adopt that recommendation, it would actually be in this bill. I think there's some confusion that it would be in Senate Bill 437, which is the Higher Ed Efficiency Act bill. But in actuality, if you choose to make that decision, you would have to make it in the work session for this bill, because this is the bill that contains the limitation that says now that no, tuition revenues are not non-limited, they are limited. So you would have to make that change in this bill if you choose to do that. I believe Mr. McGee will tell you that the governor is still reviewing this request and does not have a recommendation on that at this point.
The colleagues, I think that the issue on removing the expenditure limitation is a very important one, and that when we get into work session on it, I would like to spend some time laying out what the sideboards are on that and what the state will lose if we grant that authority. And with that, if there are no further comments for Mr. Bender, I will turn it over to Mr. McGee to give us BAM's view of the world here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, excuse me. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division, and I would like to take the opportunity to present the governor's budget for Department of Higher Education. The numbers for the governor's budget are on page 2 of my presentation. The governor is recommending a general fund appropriation of just under $780 million, which is a 3.5% reduction from the close of session budget and a 3.2% increase from the
Mr. McGee, would you kindly pull the microphone closer?
Sure. Is that better, Madam Chair?
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the $780 million roughly general fund appropriation is an increase of 3.5% from the close of session budget from 2001-03 and about a 3.2% increase from the budget at the end of the fifth special session. Lottery funds, governor's recommending $8.8 million there. Other funds limited, approximately $1.2 billion, other funds limited. And other funds non-limited, approximately $2 billion in those funds. Page 3 just shows you graphically how the different fund types are split. The budget is about 20% general fund. Lottery funds roughly equivalent to about 0%. Other funds limited, about a third of the total funds budget, and other funds non-limited, just under half of the total recommendation. On page 4, highlights the very high level, the governor's recommendation is against the total funds is a 5.2% increase from the legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The changes that occurred in the five special sessions in 2002, there were specified and unspecified reductions of $75.1 million in general fund affecting instructional, engineering, research, public service, and administrative programs. That does not include the administrative reductions directed by the governor following the December 2002 forecast. That reduced the department's expenditure authority by another $9.1 million. And Senate Bill 5548, the so-called sixth special session bill, took another $220,000 out of the budget for this department. The other issue during the special sessions were the compensation increases for 2001-03 were funded at approximately 85% of the estimated need. Highlights in the governor's budget, special session reductions are continued and biennialized into the 2003-05 biennium. There is no general fund recommended for enrollment increases that are projected by the department. Mr. Bender indicated the governor does have tuition increases of 2% per year for residents and 3.5% per year for non-residents in the budget. As we discussed at the beginning of the year, there are capital construction budgets recommended, primarily with Article 11F and other revenues rather than general fund or Article 11G. I would like to address a couple of issues that you heard about yesterday related to the governor's budget. You had a presentation from Mr. Armour regarding the Engineering Technical Industry Council. The governor's budget does include roughly $22 million in ongoing funding that was approved in the prior session. I think Mr. Armour was talking about also a increased recommendation from the ETIC group for additional funds. Beyond that ongoing level, those funds are not included in the governor's budget, although he continues to be supportive of that program. I think you also heard reference to Senate Bill 437. There are a number of issues in that bill that the governor is concerned about and DAS is concerned about, issues involving the university system's authority to operate their own benefit plan, which we believe would have a multi-million dollar impact on state government. Request to retain interest earnings on their other funds account, which would also have a multi-million dollar impact on the general fund and would perhaps create some precedent for other agencies with large other funds balances. There is language in those bills, Mr. Bender indicated on Monday, that would allow the use of certificates of participation as match against Article 11 G bonds. We have concerns about those, and we understand those either have been or will be removed from the bill by the time it gets to you. And again, Mr. Bender referred to the policy issue of whether other funds from tuition and fee revenue should be treated as non-limited, and that's another concern as well. You also heard discussion, and I think we'll hear some more today, about the deal, which is part of the board's proposal to manage the problems of affordability, access, and quality within limited state general fund resources. Part of that deal is adopted by the board calls for an influx of general fund resources over three biennia. Governor's budget does not include that, and at this point he's not supportive of that significant increase. So those are sort of things that were not in the budget that you have heard and will continue to hear about. Page 5 shows you the program units, components of the budget for the general fund side of the approximately $780 million. The largest piece, not surprisingly, is the education and general services budget, which is the instruction and administration of the research activities of the department. The Agriculture Experiment Station, Extension Service and Forest Research Lab, the three statewide public services at Oregon State University, from 7% down to 1%. Debt service makes up 3% of the general fund, and the capital construction for academic modernization, deferred maintenance, the $12.5 million we talked about Monday, that's approximately 2% of this general fund budget. Page 6 shows you basically the same display for the $4 billion total funds budget. And again, the largest component continues to be education and general services. This is about two-thirds of those total funds. The three statewide public services to the left of the chart are, again, are smaller proportions of the total. You see the other services non-limited, primarily, as we've talked about, the cost to operate food service, dormitories, various auxiliary services show up at about 14%. Services and clearing is essentially an accounting place for some internal costs that need to be recorded. Debt service remains at about 3% of the total funds. The sports action lottery funds is just slightly above zero. And finally, capital construction and total funds is about 9% of the $4 billion. Page 7 shows you where the expenditures occur, again, against the general fund budget here. About three-quarters of what the university system spend is for personal services. Not surprisingly, it's a heavy personal services issue. There's about 17% for service and supplies, 4% for capital outlay, and again, 3% for debt service. Page 8 shows you the total funds budget of $4 billion and the breakdown among categories. Personal services is about 45% of this budget, service and supplies 21%, capital outlay 11%, not surprisingly, as you add the capital construction piece in here. Debt service remains at 3%, and special payments, which are primarily student assistance to individual students, is about 20%. On page 9, I'll begin and walk you through the development of the governor's budget, beginning with the legislatively adopted budget at the close of session, which was about $808 million general fund and about $3.8 billion total funds. Legislatively approved actions through April 2002, there were really three capital construction issues here: the Oregon State University Veterinary Medical College and Engineering Building projects, Portland State University property acquisition, Native American Center buildings, and Eastern Oregon University integrated service building projects. Those were about $3.8 million general fund and $62 million total funds. second special session reduced the general fund budget for the university system by about $43.3 million general fund and $281,000 lottery funds. The major components of that were reductions in cell value funding, which you hear a little bit more later today. Those are the distributions of the campuses based on enrollment. And those are reduced between 1.7% and 6.7%, depending on graduate, undergraduate, professional students. Enrollment reserves, performance funding were eliminated. Statewide public service programs, at Oregon State University, reduced by 5%. Chancellor's office and system-wide primarily administrative expenses were reduced by 11 to 13%. The engineering enhancements that were approved in the 2001-03 budget were reduced by 5 to 7%. And there were additional reductions in research, campus public services, small school funding, and other targeted programs to get you to the $43 million reduction in the budget. The base budget adjustments, first is the roll-up of the 2001-03 compensation actions and compensation personnel action compensation changes into the 03-05 biennium. This was about $70 million general fund, $140 million total fund, and 1,500-odd positions, 420 FTE. The estimated cost of step increases for 2003-05, which includes the roll-up of 01-03 step increases, about $6.3 million general fund and $12.8 million total funds. Debt service adjustments, increases on debt service for projects that were approved and bonds were sold, increased general fund by about $264,000 and increased total funds by about $16.3 million. Capital construction adjustment simply eliminated the expenditure authority that existed. As Mr. Bender talked, those are six-year projects, so they only occur in one budget. That was an elimination of the $3.8 million general fund and $437 million total funds. And there's an adjustment in the non-limited expenditure authority of $24.8 million based on projections of expenditure needs next biennium. Essential packages 010, that's pretty standard from what you've seen. The vacancy factor and non-PIX changes increased general fund by about $1.5 million and total funds by about $3 million. Package 20, there are a number of phase-in, phase-outs, and one-time expenditures. The total amount of those were about $9.8 million general fund and about $36.1 million total fund. Those issues included the phase-in of costs to expand the College of Veterinary Medicine and continue to move towards a four-year program that is retained on campus rather than split between OSU and Washington State University. Phase-in of operation and maintenance costs for new buildings that were approved and constructed. Transfer of the National Heritage Program from the Division of State Lands. Phase-outs of expenditure limitations for certificates of participation that wouldn't continue with the new biennium. A couple of really more accounting issues, elimination of expenditure limitation for part of the fee remission program. Those are now recorded as a reduction of expense by accounting regulations. And shift of clearing and services program from non-budgeted to other funds non-limited. Again, both of those are really more accounting issues than anything else, although they're fairly large dollar amounts.
The bullet point that you have, elimination of the expenditure limitation for mm-hmm. part of the fee remission program, can you give us a little bit more information on what that is?
Madam Chair, this is sort of a case of follow the bouncing accounting rules over time. Prior to the 01-03 biennium, fee remissions, first of all, let me back up and say fee remissions are reductions in tuition and fees that are given to students for different purposes. The largest category is for retention and recruitment of students, diversity issues, excellence, special skills, low income. The other portion of that is tuition fee remissions given to graduate students is compensation for being teaching and research assistants. In the past, the first part of that, the part that was really related to retention and recruitment, was treated as what's referred to in accounting as a reduction of expense. Rather than showing as an actual expenditure, it's showing as a reduction in revenues. And prior to the 01-03 biennium, the accounting rules told us that's the way we should do it. In the 01-03 biennium, the accounting rules changed temporarily and told us, no, we needed to treat that as expenditures. So in the last legislative session, you established an expenditure limitation so we could show those as expenditures rather than a revenue adjustment. Since then, the accounting rules have changed again. So now we need to go back and treat those as a reduction of expenditures.
Okay.
So it's, again, it's fairly technical, although the dollar numbers are large.
World of accountants.
Package 30, inflation, state government service charges there. I don't think anything significant. Standard inflation increases, $5.8 million general fund, $12.2 million total funds. State government service charge increases of $8.3 million general funds and about $18 million total funds. Package 50, there were some fund shifts that were partly approved by the last legislative session, increasing general fund by about $1 million. There were fund shifts to public access account funds and interest on the engineering education investment fund balances that were established as a one-time fund shift. We need to just undo those and restore the general fund for the next biennium. And then we're correcting some debt management fees and Article 11 G bonds that are appropriately recorded as general fund rather than other funds. Package 60 is the last half of the fee remission issue we talked about a minute ago. This refers to graduate student fee remissions, which need to continue to be recorded as expenditures because those are reportable to the Internal Revenue Service as compensation to graduate students. So that part of this fee remission issue needs to be retained as expenditures. And we're doing away with a separate program of fee remission, so we're just shifting those expenditures back to the education and general services budget. So, again, a fairly technical issue. Starting with the policy packages, Package 70, the standard revenue reduction package, you'll see a reduction of $606,000 in lottery funds and $3.4 million of other funds. The lottery fund reduction is basically just an adjustment to the lottery funds forecast in December 2002. The other funds reduction references the sunset of the forest products harvest tax. House Bill 2195 would extend the sunset through 2005. And in Package 112, slightly later, we'll see restoration of those, assuming that sunset is extended. Moving on, Package 81 shows you the 2003-05 impact of the third special session decisions. That reduced general fund by $7.5 million, reduced total funds by $2.7 million, and eliminated 10 positions. There was a specified reduction for funding for information technology projects and equipment. There was elimination of the cost of living increases for top administrative positions. This is equivalent to the elimination of COLAs for salary range 38 and above for other executive branch employees. There were also unspecified reductions that were resulted in tuition and fee increases, program reductions, and reduced fund balances at the campus level. And finally, at that time, you approved an increase in extension service other funds limitation that Mr. Bender talked about due to increased revenue growth.
Mr. McGee, if I might just seek some clarification here. We had $100 million in the E-Board to cover negotiated salary increases over the interim, and as part of the rebalance package, we kept a portion of that money. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm assuming here is that the first bullet point accounts for the impact that had on the higher ed system.
Are you referring to the cost of living bullet point? The cost of living bullet point?
Yes.
That really refers to the...
Well, in the $7 million general fund fall off.
Madam Chair, let me break this out then for you in pieces. The cost of living increase is really equivalent to the elimination of cost of living increases for the salary range 38 and above. So you recall you did direct that, Governor Kitzhaber. You adopted a budget note that requested that salary cost of living increase is scheduled for the second part of the biennium be eliminated for represented and management employees. Governor Kitzhaber interpreted that to be limited to salary range 38 and above. Mm-hmm. Oregon University System is not in our PICS system, so we don't have the same personnel system that they have. This is their implementation of that same salary range 38 and above issue.
Can you give us just a short overview of how they chose to implement the decrease?
They identified a number of positions at the campus and chancellor's office level. There were 61 positions that were involved in that system-wide. Those include the chancellor, the vice chancellor, several other top administrative officials in the chancellor's office. They included the president of all universities, vice presidents, and deans in several other universities as well. And the net impact of that was a reduction of $210,000 general fund and $437,000 roughly total funds.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Bates has a question.
Yes, Madam Chair. I think you, the point you're trying to drive to is where that $7 million and $2 million total funds go, right? Okay. How much of it was made up in special fees for energy and other things? I remember a discussion that occurred a lot about second and third special session and tuition increases. How much of that was made up through tuition and fee increases?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I can't tell you how much that was specifically made up in that. We can try and get you some information overall, system-wide, on how all the reductions were accommodated, but I can't give you a specific issue here. There were some specific reductions. For example, the first bullet, reduction funding for information technology projects and equipment, that was a $3.3 million reduction in those specific line areas. We can try and get you some more information on from the campuses on how that broke out, but at each campus there was a different strategy between where program reductions were taken, where fund balances were spent down, and how issues were raised through tuition and other revenues. So we can try and get you some more detail on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please and proceed, Mr. Lee.
Thank you. Package 82 was the fifth special session, House Bill 51, Section 1 reductions. Those were the specified reductions. That reduced the budget by $4.2 million general fund and 35 positions. Those reductions were specifically targeted at the graduate education cell value, so funding distributed to the campuses based on enrollment of graduate students, and also a reduction in the 2103 engineering enhancements.
An additional question on the positions that were eliminated. Do you know if those were vacant positions or if there actually were layoffs?
I don't know for those specific positions whether that was true or not. I think there was a mix of vacant positions and layoffs. In most cases, I think the attempt was to take vacants where possible. But there may have been layoffs for those.
Thank you.
We can get you an overall information on layoffs that have occurred as a result of all the reductions. Package 84, this is the roll-up of the November 2002 Emergency Board. This increased other funds by $34.8 million and non-limited other funds by $15.8 million. This was the action by the Emergency Board to approve increased revenue from enrollment growth, tuition and fee increases, and growth in funded research. So this is an adjustment that was made in November. It's separate from the issues Mr. Bender talked to you about, reference to the letter from the board for additional other funds expenditure limitation increases for this biennium, and also separate from the impact of on the 0305 of the $91.3 million. Package 91 is the fifth special session, Section 2 reductions. These are the unspecified reductions. In this case, $59.4 million general fund reductions, 480 positions. And again, these will result in tuition fee increases, program reductions, and reduced fund balances. Again, we'll try and provide you some information on this in terms of how those were addressed. Package 92, additional program reductions, reduced the general fund budget by just under $11 million, increased other funds by about $14 million, and reduced other funds non-limited by $2.1 million. There are two issues here. This is an additional tuition increase of 2% per year on all students. The governor directed that half of the revenue of that be used to reduce the department's general fund budget, and the other half be retained by the university system to offset budget cuts. The other piece of this was the elimination of merit increase for classified employees, which were the only employees who receive automatically merit increases. So this is one of the reductions that you'll be taking in all budgets as well, and we were able to take that here separately. Moving on to page 15, package 104 was a 2003-05 enrollment increases of increasing the other funds budget by $16 million. This was increased tuition and fee revenues, assuming projected enrollment growth at 2002-03 tuition and fee rates. This is, again, separate from the $91 million Mr. Bender referred to earlier. Package 111, a tuition and revenue increase from non-resident students. This is a 1.5% per year for non-resident undergraduate and graduate students that is projected to generate $22.4 million other funds. Package 112, the Forest Research Laboratory expenditure limitation increase. This, again, restores the limitation that was reduced in Package 70 and assumes that the sunset in the forest products harvest tax will be extended. package. 150 is a non-limited expenditure limitation increase of $31 million. And these are non-limited revenues in the auxiliary services programs, the student aid program, the Oregon State University statewide public service, and debt service areas. Package 180, the capital construction projects we talked about Monday. That's $330 million other funds, the 25 projects, four campuses, the system-wide deferred maintenance, student building fee projects, and project reserves. Again, as we talked about, funded with Article 11F bonds and other revenues. Summarizing the fee and revenue change issues in the governor's budget, really, they're the tuition increases of 2% on residents and 3.5% on non-residents. And extension of the sunset of the forest products harvest tax is assumed in the budget. And finally, on page 17, there are a couple of technical adjustments. Package 70, Mr. Bender alluded to that we would request you reduce the other funds expenditure limitation for the extension service by $2.5 million. The federal grants in charge for service revenue will not occur, so the limitation is unnecessary. Capital construction, again, we talked Monday, a $45.2 million other funds increase for Article 11F bond and other revenue projects. That nets out to a technical adjustment of $42.7 million, all other funds, and you see then the total funds budget the governor's recommending is just under $4.1 billion. And that will conclude my presentation.
Questions or comments for Mr. McGee? Thank you very much. Mr. Jarvis. Please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. We'd like to begin today's presentation on funding higher education by a quick overview of the topics that we propose to review today. As you can see, we've broken this up into a series of elements, starting with a review of access, quality, and affordability and their relationship to state funding, and then working our way into the more technical elements of the construction of our budget, the flow of funding, the history, the deal, and winding up with the implications of where we sit for tuition, much of what you've heard already from Mr. Bender and Mr. McGee. With me is Senior Vice Chancellor Tom Andrews, and we'll be addressing most of these issues with a couple of our colleagues providing support, so there will be a smaller number of speakers than the numbers that you so kindly tolerated from us yesterday. We appreciate that opportunity. If I may begin with a few comments about funding of higher education, what it means, and what changes in that funding mean, and I'll keep them very brief indeed. If I could use the device of the triangle that we introduced for you yesterday, that state support dollars indeed support three primary areas of activity: access, quality, and affordability. In terms of access, that is the top priority, I think, for all of us, for the executive, for the legislature, and certainly for the State Board of Higher Education. And our goal coming into any of these endeavors as we attempt a plan is to at least maintain, and if at all possible, increase access. That's going to be a pretty tall order in the coming biennium, and I'll add a word about that in just a moment. Quality is an integral part of that. The question that access begs is indeed access to what? And quality is tied to the funding that's available through the RAM. That funding is not substitutable or replaceable from any other source. And the support that you provide to your public universities is the essential element of quality that Oregonians receive when they come to those universities.
Mr. Jarvis, if I might interrupt, there are a number of us that don't have this section in our binders.
Oh, forgive me.
I think if you had your binder here,
yep, I got it.
They put it in
there. Was an extra set.
Okay. For me too? Okay. I'm looking for mine. I'm sure. I just have a lot of stuff here. That's
oh, wait a minute.
We got it now.
Thank you.
We're with you. Go.
Oh, thank you very much.
The universe is unfolding the way that it should.
This is higher ed, paper R us. We do support the state's basic industry. lastly, on affordability, to bear in mind that whatever we do on affordability is not only a matter of the tuition, but is also critically related to associated decisions that are made with regard to financial aid. Let me just tease those out one little bit more, and that'll conclude my introduction on this. When we change state funding, and we're clearly facing a situation of change, we affect all three of these dimensions: access, affordability, and quality. When we talk about access, most of our conversation will be framed in terms of enrollment. We'll give numbers of enrollment, and we'll get into the mysteries of fundable enrollment and non-fundable enrollment later today. We'll focus on the number of students, whether it's a headcount or an FTE. We need to remember that underneath that number are the associated policy elements of diversity, of how we meet the demographics of the pipeline. There are flows of students coming towards our universities from K-12, from community colleges, Oregonians returning to this state from out of state, and transfers from the independent institutions. Those are all in the pipeline and demand that are coming into that enrollment flow. In terms of economic development, what we do for returning adult students who are looking to upgrade and change their skill sets as part of the economic development of our state, that's a key policy element of what happens under enrollment, and residency is a key set of decisions that affect enrollment. So although most of our conversations today and tomorrow will be focusing on the enrollment numbers, they flow out into those other policy areas and affect the decisions that you make and you ask us to make and that we come to. When we talk about affordability, we'll focus mainly on the tuition numbers today, and we've acknowledged their dependence on financial aid, both federal financial aid, state financial aid through the Opportunity Grant, and institutional fee remissions. Those take place in the context of the relationship to income, and it is the relationship to income that drives the F grade that we've received in our national report card. And that takes place in the context of debt for the individual student. The impact of financial aid and affordability is a debt implication, and that's something we'll talk about a little later on today. And finally, under quality, the most important element of quality is indeed the funding that you all provide through the funding of the resource allocation model. It drives consequences in all of the following areas: the rates at which students graduate from our institutions, our ability to sustain sponsored research, which is net income generation coming into the state, our faculty salaries, the preparation of students for our institutions, class size, and course availability. That's what we mean by quality in the institution, and all of that flows from and is tied integrally to the support for the RAM that we'll be talking about just momentarily. So to just keep us all aware of the vast array of policy connections that come from these very simple headings of access, quality, and affordability. If I could respond to questions that came up in the last couple of days on the characteristics of our students, and I thought I'd try and give a series of snapshots on questions that one might reasonably ask. As you saw from Mr. Bender, our headcount enrollment in the fall of 2002 was of the order of 78,000 students. How do those break down? Well, approximately 86% of them are resident. We're primarily serving Oregon residents, 14% non-resident. We're primarily undergraduate institutions, 81% undergraduate and 20% graduate. That 20% graduate is a very important part of our complement. 79% of our students are full-time students, and 21% are part-time. That hides the fact that the vast majority of our students work. So the vast majority of our full-time students are also working students. And it is a known national result that once those levels of work, those commitments to work outside of the academic arena, exceed 10 to 12 to 15 hours a week, there tends to be an academic consequence. It's not a mystery that the more time students have to spend making up their financial complement, there is a price for that in their ability to sustain their academic work. So yes, 79% full-time, but most of those students also are working students in Oregon today. 24% of our undergraduates are over 25. Of our undergraduates are over 25. 59% of our undergraduates enter directly from high school. In some ways, perhaps a more interesting way to put that is that 4 out of 10 of our undergraduates didn't come to us directly from high school. They came through another pathway that typically involved a work experience, a community experience, a timeout for family and caregiving. 14% of our students took at least one community college course in the last year. We are a much more intermingled and swirling system than most of us think. Most of us come from a generation when students went to a place, took some credits, completed or didn't complete a qualification, and went to another place. The student transferred. That is a rather poor representation of what actually happens in education today. Students gather credits from multiple sources and compile them at an institution where they seek to credential it. So there is much more flow across and within our system than these simple numbers represent. So hopefully those give you some elements of the characteristics of our students that you were asking us about in the last couple of days. And I'll take a break there and take any questions and hand over to the vice chancellor.
Please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Andrews. I'm the Senior Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration at the Oregon University System. What I'd like to do is start out with some definitions. Some of these issues came up the other day and probably need to clarify those as soon as possible. First, fundable enrollment. Basically, that is an enrollment that is eligible for state funding, fundable. As you can see, generally that's going to be resident students. There are some exceptions, but the vast, vast majority are resident students. Eastern is kind of an exception by constitution. All students are resident students. So if they come from Idaho or Washington or someplace, they are a resident student. Non-funded enrollments. No state dollars will support these enrollments. They are not enrollments that go through the model, as we'll see. Basically, your non-residents are what we're talking about here. Unfunded fundable. These are FTEs that are eligible for state funding, but because of the lack of state funding or diminished resources, they would not be funded. They would exist only on the tuition dollars that they bring in. And that will be a bigger piece of a discussion that we'll have shortly as to how we may be looking at that more than certainly we have in the past. And directly to a question that came up yesterday on full-time equivalent, where it came up with in regards to Cascades, if you're an undergraduate student in the system, you are a full-time equivalent if you take 45 student credit hours during the year. If you are a graduate student at a master's level or a professional student, it's 36 credits during the year. And if you're a doctoral student, it's 27. So I think that is the way they are calculated at all of the campuses.
So if I might just ask for clarification on the FTE definition, if you have a student that's taking 45 credit hours over three terms, but they're not 15 credit hours in each term, I guess the question is, do you take the number of bodies and divide it by the number of credits and come up with your FTE?
Chair Morgan, what we'll do is we have a specific, it's all really built on student credit hours. So if somebody takes 12 and then they take 15 and they take 30, what we're really doing is looking at the total of student credit hours and dividing by 15 if it's undergraduate.
Okay. I see what you're doing.
Next, in just a couple of very brief statements in regards to the governor's budget. And Bill has really done an excellent job. Mr. McGee has done an excellent job in presenting the information, so I don't need to say too much. But what I think you need to know is that as we look at that level, the general fund support, we define that as being able to provide availability for 115,258 full-time equivalent students. Now, we've come to that number on the basis of looking at where we're at in this year, this fiscal year, or academic year, and saying at a minimum, we want to be able to continue that level of participation into the next 2 years in the biennium. That was one important piece of this. But it has to be remembered that level is built on the governor's recommended budget. Also, there's been discussions already about tuition increases. The tuition increases that are built into the governor's budget are based on originally what we had requested with some discussion. A lot has happened over the last 9 or 10 months, and we have been talking with our board, and we'll be bringing forward to the governor and to you additional background on further tuition increases. In fact, we'll talk a little bit about that later. At the next slide, what we've tried to do and what we'll be moving forward as we go through today, as we go through the priorities and the reductions, there is a resource allocation model that is built on certain programs, and you'll be seeing that as we move forward. What we're trying to do as it relates to the governor's budget, which put an emphasis from our standpoint on access, is to not only look at access, but how we can tie access and quality together. You're going to hear a lot of the access, quality, affordability, but we think it all makes sense. This does continue, as Mr. McGee said, the reductions that we felt in 2001 and 2003. And I think as we look at that in regards to our tuition strategy, we'll see a connection as well. I want to just highlight elements of the resource allocation model. There are a number of pieces to this. And actually, if you're looking for more detail, more background on history, structure, strengths, weaknesses, there's a paper on pages 8 through 13 behind your Day 2 tab. Really goes through and provides what I think is a pretty good snapshot of the model. What I'll do briefly is go through and highlight the two major aspects of the model and move on from there. There are three distinct components to the model. One is the self-funding, enrollment-driven. That's the one we'll really focus on most today. And then there are targeted programs that are not enrollment-driven. And that will really get a heavy focus as we look at both the priority-setting process and the reduction scenarios over the next couple of days. You'll quite an emphasis in that area. The general fund is, right now, the funding that we receive from the legislature comprises 70% of that toward this enrollment-driven model. So 70% of the dollars that you provide are based on objective enrollment-related data, and that amounts to $517 million. The camp, and as we'll talk also going through this in a number of different ways, the dollars follow the student, meaning that where the numbers of students are based on the courses that they take, the dollars go to those campuses. It does not reside centrally for some other methodology of distribution. And finally, the $118,000 that we mentioned on certainly more than one occasion is possible only if the governor's budget recommendation is supported. Looking at the next slide, you'll see that there's looking at the 100.
Excuse me, sorry. Representative March has a question.
Thank you. It sort of just begs a question. Where's the other 30% go?
Representative March, Chair Morgan, the other 30% are the targeted programs. And I'll be going through all aspects of the enrollment-driven, and then we'll spend just a couple of slides on the targeted programs. Okay?
Thank you.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. If we could return to the slide titled, What is the RAM? Slide 11. The component that is focused on performance-based raises a question about the elimination of the performance funding in the budget that we are looking at. Can you tell us what the impact, what are the impacts that we should be mindful of?
Sure.
Look at this piece.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, we had identified about $2 million for performance funding, which was eliminated actually in the last year or so. What those dollars were doing was providing in about six or seven specific areas incentives to institutions based on board goals to strive for higher access, employability. There were a number of different factors. What's really happened in terms of the follow-through on that, and there'll be a whole day spent on performance, is that we continue to have the expectations of the institutions, but there will not be the incentive funding to get to those points. So we're, in effect, the program continues, but without those dollars as an incentive.
All right, I'll look forward to the other discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
The $118,000 that I've mentioned is arrayed in this particular slide by institution. So we can see anywhere from 4,500 up to 32,000 FTE at the campuses, again, based on the funding from the governor's recommended budget. Also, we are looking at the possibility, with additional tuition increases, to be able to serve an additional 6,730 students. Again, the combination means the tuition increases that we'll be talking about, as well as the governor's budget recommendation. Now, that 6,700 FTE would be funded on tuition dollars only. It would not be funded through the general fund. And I think that's an important a point to make.
I need to have some clarification here. I'm going back to the bar graph that Mr. Bender gave us that was based on headcounts. And then I'm looking at this slide that you have up that's based on enrollment, which I'm assuming is FTE.
This is fundable enrollments. That's correct, full-time equivalent students.
It's confusing to me, and perhaps you can help me understand why the FTE is so much greater than the headcount.
I'm sorry, Chair Morgan, this is a biennial total. The 118,000 is biennial.
Okay. So if I were to add these two numbers together, I would
hopefully get more. Never quite that simple. There's always something.
No, I understand.
It's very confusing from our end as well, believe me. Okay, next slide. How does the RAM structure? How exactly does this work? What we have, perhaps the most basic point in the RAM is, in the resource allocation process, is trying to identify a set of peers, of comparator information that we can use to identify with, to benchmark to. And what the model was developed and based on was the idea that we could identify the median of similar institutions, similar size, similar programs, in kind of a composite, given that we are different size institutions, different programs, but develop that in a way that we could then benchmark and say, what is it within institutions that are similar to us? What is the funding that they're receiving on the average? And in fact, then how do we compare to that? So that is that's the most basic point of the model, is identifying information by discipline. We've got information where political science, we know how much it costs per student, a full-time equivalent student, at a variety of institutions. We can look at that and we can see how does that compare to OUS institutions. We have a great deal of peer information on faculty salaries, tuition and fees. It's kind of this combined set of information that allows us then to build the model and build a kind of a sense of an average, if you will. We'll look at it shortly, too, in that there's specific funding values that we can tie into that are based on that average that we then look at as the means of coming back and saying, okay, we have X number of students taking so many types of courses. Here's what we think we should be realizing in terms of funds based on what our peers are receiving or similar types of institutions. Looking at the next slide, I think a good way to do this in kind of a practical sense is look at page 12 and 13 in your tab 2, day 2 tab. Should be a table A and a table B. The funding values that we have are, the focus is really on 12 cells. The 12 cells are based on 4 levels of instruction and 3 levels of cost. You've got freshman, sophomore, you've got junior, senior, master's, and doctoral as the levels of instruction. And then the levels of cost, 1, 2, 3, are low, medium, and high cost. Those 12 really are where the vast majority of that $500 million is that we receive. Is run through this particular model. Now, each cell represents the average state share, and I emphasize state, we'll get back to tuition shortly, for the cost of one FTE student. So if you look at level 1, freshman, sophomore, you'll see $2,866. That's $2,866 going back to the development of a full-time equivalent, 45 student credit hours undergraduate will drive $2,866. So every campus that has one FTE at that level will get $2,866. And so on as you look at numbers of enrollments by junior, senior, level two, master's, and so forth. In the end, the number of FTE students or the student credit hours that are being generated in each of these cells determines then how many dollars they'll receive from the state for instruction and instructional support. That drives and justifies a funding need. What we came back to the governor with originally in a revised request was, instead of saying we want to have a fully funded request, which means we want to be fully funded at the average of our peers, we came back and said, given the financial issues, fund us at 80%. That would actually be an increase in terms of where we were at the time. So we weren't even at that point looking at fully funding. Basic point, numbers of students and the courses that they're enrolled drive the funding in a way I think that is grounded in fairly good objective information.
Representative Bates.
Looking at level one, level two, level three, so I'm understanding this, there are some dramatic differences, it appears to me, by what you are asking for as far as funding at those different levels, correct?
That's correct.
And the degree of detail here, of course, is limited. It just seems that level three, some things seem strange to me. Leisure and fitness studies, parks and recreation, visual and performing arts are level threes.
Yes. Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, what this is built on is literally looking at each of those areas, recreation, and ones that probably also seem fairly obvious, a law, engineering, high cost. It's going through and identifying each of those disciplines and arraying them on a level, on a kind of a 1 through 50 level, and seeing how they fall in a 1, 2, 3 scenario. And what we found is those that are at level 3 are the high cost programs within, you know, again, each of the cells. So this is actually based on specific instances in relationship to other similar institutions.
Madam Chair, it just seems strange to me that that's the only criteria you used. You might have taken a criteria of what's most important to our society, or what we want to drive things in as a policy issue. This is a policy issue more than a financial one, but this seems very strange to me, just the first look at it.
Chair Morgan and Representative Bates, there is more than goes into this. I have to say, what we do, when the model was originally built, we were looking at the actual expenditures just at OUS and saying, actually kind of some of the questions that you're, I think, raising is, where do we want to be with education? Where do we want to be with engineering? Where do we want to be with certain programs? And how do we influence that within the cells? The actual information, I think, drove much of what we have here. But as we look at various add-ons or an engineering program, when we get to the targeted programs, you'll see that we've made really some fairly specific policy decisions to enhance certain programs, because the cells, as in terms of the value, the relative value to what was really needed, was not enough.
Please ask them to continue. I'll just follow up.
Well, Madam Chair, Sandra, if I could just follow up on Representative Bates' question. The schools of education, for example, would fall within, would that be level one?
Schools, yes.
Two.
Well, education is level two. We've got education level two.
Okay. We can continue, Madam Chair.
Okay. I am just wanting to make sure that I have this in my head. Having worked with this concept over the interim, it's interesting to actually see it laid out in its basis here. Mm-hmm. What these numbers represent in the matrix that you have at the top is what you see as the state share of the cost of educating students. Where does it exist that the numbers, are they in here for the total cost somewhere?
Representative Morgan, no. And what I'd like to do is, if I could flip into that, I'll get to that point. But there is actually no separate matrix, overall matrix, that says at freshman, sophomore, it's going to be $7,000, and so much is tuition, so much is indirect cost, and so much is state. That does not exist.
Then, if you don't know the total cost, how did you estimate what the state portion was?
Chair Morgan, what we did is we looked at peer institutions, and this is very specific peers in terms of each of the institutions. What we looked at was the breakout of their funding, the state share versus the student share. And we made judgments about is it 50-50, is it 40-60, in terms of when the model was originally built. That then became a part of the way that all of this was developed. I think if you were to look at this in aggregate, and maybe this is the best way to look at it, I think you could assume in aggregate that there should be a tuition dollar that exists for every state dollar. And if there is more funding there that's actually existing on the tuition side, it's because, at least presently, the state is underfunding its share of that overall commitment.
Then the information that you're using that are based on peer institutions, are they also based on the fact that there is no total overall cost? But what I'm trying to get at here is the peer information that you're using on the same basis where it just estimates the state contribution?
Representative Morgan, we have a cost. Let's say, as an example, political science. We'll know the full cost, but we have to make the assumption for our own purposes how that would be split between the state and the student. But we do not and have not developed a separate matrix that encompasses the full cost versus, or say another matrix for tuition.
So there is no information by campus on how much it actually costs to educate the students in these different levels?
Representative Morgan, including the tuition?
All the costs.
No, there is no separate document or piece of information that says here's how much is going into English specifically, like an actual expenditure.
And why was the choice made not to account that way?
That I can't say. I don't know. I wasn't here.
It is, I think, one of the great frustrations as we sit on this side of the table trying to make policy decisions that we don't have any actual numbers. What I hear you say is that we have actually no way to know whether these cell values actually relate to our costs. Is that a true statement?
No, I don't think so, Representative Morgan. What I'm saying is that when the model was developed, the approach was to look at what it cost on a discipline basis to provide one level of provide one FTE of instruction. But there was a conscious decision at an institutional level to know that to provide the service, the student was going to be contributing 50% of the dollars or 40% of the dollars at the time, and the state was presenting 60%. And we were then taking that cost and merely identifying what then would be the appropriate state share. It was taking an average of what was the state share relative to all of those peers and then applying it to the discipline value. And then, hence, you would get a value of the state share based on that in each of these various cells. And what we've done since then is really update or up based on inflationary figures. We're actually going through a very detailed review now again of all of the various discipline costs since the initial time to make sense out of, are they changing? Are there changes we should be considering?
Mr. McGee, you look like you might have something to add to this conversation.
Perhaps, Madam Chair, I'll take a shot at it. The RAM was adopted at a time when the system, with the approval of the legislature, was moving to a more market-driven approach to providing education services. And one of the things that was approved at that time was to allow the campuses to retain their own tuition so that it would not be pooled centrally and then distributed by the board and the chancellor's office. And having done that, then the question is, how do you allocate the general fund appropriation among the campuses? if they're retaining their tuition. And so the model was really driven as a way to, on an enrollment basis, based on the type of courses that were being offered at different campuses, to divide the appropriation among the campuses. And so I think the need at that point was really to find a methodology to decide how the state dollars would be allocated among the seven institutions under the assumption that they would retain their own tuition revenues. I'm not sure that, I think that's sort of the history. I'm not sure it satisfies your concerns, but I think that's sort of why we are here today. It's the task that was being confronted at the time the RAM was adopted.
Well, and I think the frustration that I'm trying to express is that in our search for efficiencies, we have an accounting model that doesn't actually account for how dollars are spent. It accounts for some kind of pure institution way of looking at spending. I'm finding this quite frustrating.
Well, Chair Morgan, let me try it from another standpoint. This is a model that identifies, as Mr. McGee said, there's dollars that reside at the campus that are tuition dollars. These dollars, general fund, go to the campus based on this methodology. We have actual expenditures. We know how dollars are being expended in terms of that combined resource. It would be your E&G expenditures down to identifiable individual account levels. So there's a methodology in terms of identifying the amount that's needed, and there is in fact an expenditure review process that takes place at the end. But there is not in the middle of that a specific model that identifies that total realm of general fund and tuition fund dollars and how it would be, again, generated as a revenue, which is really what the model does.
I think perhaps we should just continue through the presentation, and I'm sure we'll evolve this conversation as we go along.
Okay, looking at the next... One aspect that we'll find is, and again going to what Mr. McGee said, that campuses were given a good deal more flexibility when the model came out and was seen as a means of being more market-driven. That means their enrollment management planning had to be quite different, and I think looking more at the differences that existed within their campuses and where they wanted to be down the road, which meant looking very much at the different kinds of programming, and looking at how the programming linked specifically to the kinds of enrollments that they would want, the kinds of programs that they would have, and how that connected with this model and funding opportunities. The model, again, is partially funding instruction, academic support, libraries, student services, counseling. It is that tuition component that, in conjunction with the general fund, basically provides all of the services that we've got today. Going to the next slide, knowing that, how exactly does funding compare to the, quote, average of similar universities, average as it relates to the state general fund? What we've got is a very general, single, system-wide standard that says, relative to the median of our peers, or to those comparators, we stand at 72%. The quality funding index, stateside, 72%, or 28% below the peers. Now, that would be at 28% if we can maintain the enrollments at the level as suggested in the governor's budget. That's the basic elements of the enrollment-driven part of our funding, the 70% of the dollars.
Let me ask another what may turn out to be a very stupid question. The position that our system holds with its peers, is that based on what is actually funded or what would be computed as a full state contribution?
Chair Morgan, it was originally built on actual expenditures. The original model that was developed was looking at actual expenditures by discipline.
Okay, so when you say that
we fund our university system at 28% below peers. Is that actual dollars or is that sell value dollars?
Chair Morgan, that would be sell value dollars. We're using a standard right now that we're assuming exists, and we're comparing what's happening with that in terms of our funding relative to that standard.
Is there any way that I think, I mean, there is a value in discussing sell values and where we are relative to the sell value, but is there any way to introduce information into this conversation that reflects what the actual funding is in our peer institutions related to that sell value?
Chair Morgan, we can do that. I mean, when you say actual, my only concern is the model is built on actuals, but the model itself has not been updated in terms of actual expenditures within the last 3 or 4 years. It still is working off of that original information and updated by inflation. We do have more recent information now, which actually will reflect that the sell value will be even lower. But maybe one good way to look at it is that the sell value, when we say 72%, perhaps the best way to look at it is that if you were to take the average cost per student, we are at a level that is 28% below where, quote, peers or comparator institutions are. If you look at if you take the $517 million and you utilize the fundable FTE number, that's about $4,500 per student on an average. What we're saying is we should be in the range of 25% to 30% below that funding relative to the peers. Is another way of looking at it.
What I'm saying is I would be interested in knowing where the peers are in relation to the sell values also.
Chair Morgan, you're looking kind of for what is the most recent current way of ensuring that the sells that we've got are actually accurate, I guess.
Correct. Yep. And sure. What I'm doing here is making the assumption that the state funding for our peers is in somewhat the same boat that our state funding for the university system in this state is,
mm-hmm.
and that I would imagine that there is quite robust downward pressure, or not pressure necessarily, but ability to fund because of the revenue situations within the state. So I think it would be an interesting element to introduce into the committee's discussion just what the reality is here rather than the sell value.
Chair Morgan, we have got some updated information, and we should be able to come up with some reasonable good comparisons to make based on that.
Thank you.
In looking at that quality funding index, what we've seen is, as really already been identified by the committee, there has been significant growth, significant demand for the services, and we've had a reduction in the quality funding index. And obviously the two are linked. Even if funding were flat and had remained the same, if enrollment grows, the quality funding index goes down. And obviously we're in a growth mode. But with the state general fund going down at the same time that enrollment is increasing, that makes an even larger gap. Then the next chart, and this kind of goes back to a lot of the discussions we've had already. If we decide to maintain the position that we want to maintain quality at that 72% level, then what we're looking at is an impact on access. If we have the amount of funding is decreased and we want to maintain that 72%, we're going to be looking at less access. Then finally, the targeted programs, getting back to Representative March, the second component of our model are targeted programs. These are not enrollment-driven, approximately 30% of the state funding. It's a big emphasis is on the statewide public service programs, which you'll be doing separately, but that's a big component. Some of the key programs include, next slide, some of the key programs include campus public service programs. And we'll be talking about a number of these tomorrow on the priority listing and on the reduction scenarios as well. It includes research, the state-supported research, engineering support, includes the chancellor's office. You have a number of administrative activities that are part of the targeted program, system-wide expenses, capital construction, and debt service. There, that the combination then of the enrollment driven with these targeted programs represent the funding that we're receiving and that or that the governor would be recommending and how we would allocate that.
Sure. Mr. McGee. Yeah.
Madam Chair, one clarification I'd like to make. In Mr. Andrews' presentation, he's indicated to you what I believe is really a policy decision that this OUS is advocating rather than a specific recommendation from the governor. And that is to hold the sell values at 72% and not increase that anymore, with the result that enrollment would be held at the 118,000 figure that Mr. Andrews talked about. That is a policy decision. It's not one that I'm implying that the governor is not supportive of. I'm simply indicating that is not one that he has explicitly chosen in preparing the budget. So there is a choice between whether you fluctuate enrollment or fluctuate the sell value amount, and the system is bringing forward to you a proposal that would hold enrollment in order to maintain a sell value.
Thank you.
Chair Morgan, that's true. There was no indication within the governor's recommendations of what they may have desired. This is a board position that they would be looking at the 72% level.
Senator Mesker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like clarification on slide 20. In regards to land-grant universities, is there a requirement of maintaining those statewide programs in a land-grant university?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, yes, there is. There is a very specific land grant, very historical statutes that exist that for Oregon State. Yeah. Yes.
Could you give us some background on specifically what that means?
Chair Morgan, it goes back to Mr. Bender's presentation earlier. There is the cooperative extension. There is the Agricultural Experiment Station. There's the Forestry Research Lab. Those are the three major programs for statewide public service programs that are typical of kind of single university mandates throughout the country that were part of the, I don't know if it was the Morrill Act in 1862 at some point, but they were specifically designated for that purpose. But it's those three programs that he had mentioned earlier that would comprise that mandate.
Madam Chair, if we could have some information on what those mandates are, what levels of funding is required, or what level of program is required, I think it would be helpful.
I think also, if we could, Mr. Bender, that would be great background information to have when we do the statewides. Representative March.
Yes, thank you. And I'm kind of following up on your questioning around the discipline funding. And normally it costs more to educate at the graduate level. And in particular, I notice recreation, leisure, and fitness are at a level 3 in undergraduate education. And they all of a sudden drop to a level 2 in graduate at the master's level, so that like a junior in recreation or fitness is you're reimbursing at $69.82. When they suddenly become a master's student, they're reimbursed at $63.12, so they're actually less money. And I was wondering, when you're looking at these various schools and comparing peer institutions, are you taking into account the fact or the possibility that some other institutions may be subsidizing their, for example, football or basketball programs through the model?
Chair Morgan, Representative March, I think one thing you have to remember is that when you look, as an example, at level 1, we're taking an average of all of those and coming up with a number. So there can be a program, perhaps it's leisure, the leisure studies, perhaps it's health professions, that are at a higher level of actual cost as they are located in that, and when we give them, when they're provided money back, it's actually at less value than what they need. But on an average, then, there would be others that are within that cell that are getting more. I mean, I'm not sure, why one would be in one cell versus another. There could be more laboratories in the undergraduate component where they're seeking to have more labs, more higher cost programming. I can't speak to that specifically, but I'm assuming that that has some influence.
Yeah, I'd take another look at that. Thank you.
I think we're going to be in a race to the finish line here.
I'd like to introduce Marv Weigel now on funding sources.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marv Weigel, Associate Vice Chancellor for Budget and Management for the Oregon University System, and I'd like to present very briefly an overview of the proposed OUS budget for the '03-'05 biennium, and specifically I'd like to talk about the sources of our funding and where and how those funds are expended. Next slide. A bit earlier today, Mr. McGee from the governor's office did an excellent job of presenting an overview of the OUS budget based on essentially on fund types. And as you recall, his presentation at a very high level looks something like the slide that's currently on the screen behind me. The budget was sorted by general fund, lottery funds, other funds, and other funds non-limited. For purposes of this presentation, I'd like to recast the governor's budget a bit differently. If we could have the next slide, I'd like to talk about the OUS budget in terms of operating funds and other funds. You'll note on the slide that the total OUS budget, all funds, as proposed by the governor for '03-'05, exceeds $4 billion. Of that, operating funds represent 42% of the total, and other funds represent 58% of the total. Next slide, please. When speaking of operating funds, I'm talking about the revenues that fund the core campus operations, including instruction, departmental research, campus public services, student services, academic and institutional support, and operation and maintenance of physical plants. Next slide. The sources of these funding for these core operations are the legislature, which provides 46.5% of the operating revenue through the appropriation of state general fund and lottery funds, students, who provide 42.5% through tuition and fees, and the federal government and others, who provide 11% through indirect cost recovery, interest income, and miscellaneous sales and services. These are all funding sources over which the legislature exercises direct control, either through appropriation or by granting limitation. Next slide. The legislature also retains control, although it's less direct, over other funds through the continuous appropriation contained in, I believe it's ORS 351. For purposes of this discussion, other funds are essentially those that cannot be used to support core campus operations as defined earlier. They include self-support programs and restricted funds. Self-support programs such as auxiliaries, which include student housing, food services, athletics, bookstores, and other similar operations, designated operations including workshops and field trips and other community education projects provided by institutional departments, and service departments which are internal to the campuses, such as printing and telecom. These are all programs which provide or which produce sufficient operating revenue through fees, through ticket sales, through chargebacks, through sales of goods and services to recover the full cost of their operations. It's important to keep in mind that these are not profit centers, but they are in fact required to break even. Restricted funds, next slide please, as their name implies, are those funds whose use is restricted by external donors or other agencies for specific purposes. Gifts, grants, and contracts, student aid, loan funds, capital construction grants, and bond proceeds, debt service, these are all restricted in their use and consequently are not available for funding core campus operations. Next slide. There are a number of sources of other funds, as noted on the slide behind me at this point. Most notable are gifts, grants, and contracts, which are comprised principally of federal research grants and contracts, as well as student aid, and they make up almost 50% of other funds' revenues. You'll also note that students provide 22% and private investors nearly 15% of this funding. Next slide. These funds, both operating and other funds, flow to the campuses in specific ways, as you'll note on the slide that will follow this one. State and general fund appropriations are allocated to the campuses by the Chancellor's Office in the manner and the amounts directed by the State Board of Higher Education, the legislature, and the governor's office, and all other operating and non-operating funds flow directly to the campuses, again, as noted on the next slide. Which I lost. It's interesting to note that the current governor's budget provides 19.6% of the total U.S. budget that students, through paying tuition and fees and funding such self-support programs as student housing, food services, and bookstores, provide nearly 30%. And the federal government, through research grants and contracts and student aid, provides over 40%. In short, there are multiple sources of campus funding, almost 60% of it restricted in use by statute and other constraints, and over 80% of it flowing directly to the campuses from the funding sources. And I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point.
It appears you're getting off the hook very easily here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Richard Jarvis, for the record, and I apologize. Grant and Cairns has been called away on a family emergency, and there are certainly shoes that I would not pretend to be able to fill, and these are two of them. And let me try and capture a little bit of the history, and of course, any question you ask me, I won't be able to answer. But I'll try and do the three points.
Deferred answers to questions in this area.
Thank you. Just to remind us of a context that, at least on the first point, Mr. McGee reminded us that the current budget situation that we're in is part of a major contextual shift that took place in 1999 when we moved from a very centralized system with, in terms of the flow of funds you just saw, much more money remaining to be centrally allocated and dispersed, to a much more decentralized system in which the enrollment drivers took the money to, kept the money on the campuses, and that is still where we are today. The second point is to remind us that once again we are depending in these very tough times on the application of increased efficiencies which we would seek to realize through increased flexibility, and that's the purpose of the requests for flexibility in our relationships with the state, in order to support additional access. And what we're trying to do is to turn flexibility into efficiency to be able to work quicker and faster so that we can support more students, because we know the number of state dollars is going down relative to the increase in enrollments. We've done this before when we've brought you an efficiency act. We've traded efficiency for access. We're essentially applying the same set of principles in this budget approach here. And lastly, we are turning to our students very heavily, and that'll be a theme that I will approach later today, or if you wish, the beginning tomorrow. Every time there is a sharp budget crisis, we turn to the students in the immediate short term to help backfill reductions in general fund. That's what these tuition increases are doing. They are getting us through these tough times, and that is a very tough burden for the students who are caught in that box of timing to deal with. So as we move and talk about tuition, it falls in that context that the whole budget that we need to support instruction and research and public service over the next biennium desperately needs the RAM support, needs the efficiencies because those translate into access dollars, and needs the tuition that we're asking permission to seek. So if I may just tackle one more slice of this, and that is to elaborate a little bit on the deal, which again Mr. McGee mentioned, and to recognize that the funding proposal within the deal is certainly not recognized in the governor's budget and is at this point a somewhat disappearing memory. What it represented was an attempt to recognize the reduction in availability of state funds and to recognize that a funding model, the RAM, which was originally funded in 1999 at 90% of the average of our peers, that's where we stood in 1999. We've already fallen so far below that it seemed pointless last fall to keep asking for 90% of something that was unattainable. And so the deal said, well, could we back that off to 80%? And we're now falling further below that. That was a funding piece of it. If there are no dollars granted on that principle, there are a number of other elements in the proposal of the board that still remain important for our discussion and that we would hope could still be part of our conversation. That is to recognize that anything we say about state funds affects one, and if you affect one, access, quality, and affordability ripple through that relationship. You can't deal with one without dealing with the others. That we are desperate to see some commitment to reinvest in this system. It is a system that is taking a series of batterings on our budgetary side, and that when the economy returns, could we see some element of commitment to return to growth and return to reinvestment as the economy permits? That was a proposal within the deal to say, could we look beyond just the immediate short term? To recognize that we are asking a great deal of our students, and that we're trying to propose in the course of this budget set of deliberations, that we think about what a fair share with the students would be. I would have to tell you, having spent now 30 years in public systems in this country and 10 years in system level budget hearings, I never thought I'd reach the day when I'd be talking about a 50-50 fair share. I thought it was amazing when I dropped below two-thirds, one-third. I thought it was amazing when I dropped below 60-40. And for me to be even using 50-50 language with you is a personal shock for me. Right now would be a pretty good target to get back to. I would hope that whatever we have to ask of tuition, and I'm going to ask you for some pretty tough numbers, we would see that the return to a state student share is something about which we could express some hope in the future, and that be handled in a way that is at least predictable to our students. At the moment, that they are being hit by the waves of fortune and largely misfortune. To recognize, too, that part of the deal approach was to say it's not just about the teaching that we're focusing on today through the RAM. There is also an important research function that we need to incent and continue, because that is not entirely supported by the funds that come in from external resources, and that enhanced efficiency is a part of the enrollment that we need to make. We can't maintain access unless we're able to realize the benefits of those efficiency proposals. We will not be able to support the same number of students at the level of quality that you have seen in the past for these institutions. So that's the package of ideas that comes behind this proposal, regardless of what the dollar amount is. And those thoughts underlie our request of you today. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to go into tuition or defer it at your request. It's a longer package than 10 minutes, I might imagine.
I rather suspect that the 10 minutes we have left will be inadequate to address tuition, and so I would very much, I think, be willing to push that off to begin tomorrow's discussion. Are there any questions or comments on the principles of the deal? I think that this was a very interesting conversation that we had today, and it appears that there is no further conversation. Mr. Bender, do you have anything to add?
No, I did. I did want to mention that with the RAM, and this reflects on what Mr. McGee said as well, at the time that the legislature adopted the RAM in 1999, the state was moving to a system where it was trying to provide the institutions with greater incentives to improve their quality, to improve their competitiveness. And the RAM does that. It's very effective in doing that because it makes the state, each institution's funding, very dependent upon their ability to attract and retain students. And it is thereby helping to provide that incentive. Also, the RAM is much more transparent in how funding is provided to institutions than the system that it replaced had been. And I think that this is a very fine improvement in the RAM, and it allows the state to see how institutions are really getting the amount of funding that they are through the system. Whereas before, it was not impossible to see, but it was very complicated, and there were a lot of items that help a lot of things that weren't really as clear. At the time that it was adopted, I believe that OUS had the hope that it would be used also as the method for determining what the state's funding would be. And that when we talk about restoring funding to a certain percentage, basically it's that concept, that the RAM be used to determine what the level of funding is. But the state has never, since it's been adopted, used the RAM to actually determine the state appropriation level. If you look at the governor's process, which Mr. McGee outlined, all of that was independent of what any of those numbers were in that matrix. I mean, if OUS had changed all the numbers completely, that would not have had any impact on the amount of what the request was, or how the legislature, frankly, has been looking at these budgets since the RAM has been adopted. But the RAM is still distributing funds among the institutions and providing the incentives to the institutions to be effective in increasing their enrollments and retaining students. Now that the state contribution is going down, you have a system where institutions have a strong incentive to get more students, but you know, where's the funding coming from to actually cover those students? So there are all these pressures that are occurring at the campus level, but I think one of the dichotomies we see here is whether the RAM itself and those cell values is being used as the method for determining what the state's funding level will be. And we have never done that in that manner. And I think that's, you know, part of the issue that's coming up here. And also, just to note that when you look at these cell values, and if you question, well, should this particular course really be in this box or that box, those are legitimate concerns, but note that the impact of where those particular course levels are, the effect is in determining how funds are distributed among the seven campuses. It hasn't been having an effect the way the state's been budgeting in how much we've been providing. So if something's in the wrong box, which I don't have any particular reason to believe that things are in the wrong box. I know that some campuses question this over time and it constantly evolves. But if something is in a box that doesn't look right to you, what the impact is, then that the distribution among campuses may be different than what you think would be the best way to do it, but it's not affecting the total amount that the state is providing in funds, in general fund, to the system.
But it would it not, impact the amount of money that the campuses would receive from OUS?
Yes. So this is a distribution model, and you'll see the same issues with community colleges when you take them up. With community colleges, basically the cell values of all programs are the same. They don't have a differentiated structure like this. So in this sense, higher ed has developed a system to distribute its funds amongst institutions that's more really cost-based than what we have in a community college system, where a student that would be in a program that might have a very high cost, it might be some kind of technical program where you can only have very few students per instructor, they would receive from the state the same funding for a program where you might be able to just take a classroom and fill it up with a lot of students and one instructor, and it's really not as expensive. For the higher ed model, there is a differentiation. So the types of programs that are more expensive, the campus gets a bigger portion of the pie, essentially, for those programs than for the programs that are less expensive.
Well, it's a distribution model, but it's performance-based. Dollars follow the students
exactly. To
those institutions that will meet their needs. That have the programs and services that will meet their needs.
There's also a question, though. I was, thinking in a broader sense of values in terms of societal values, and you're always looking back, and historically, if you're using this kind of a model and you're not basing it on where our goals are, where's Oregon's goals? We're basing it on where other states have put their money traditionally over the past, and not necessarily where we feel, for example, education. We might feel that education has, there's a greater value in teaching teachers than some other issues. And so there's also, when you're looking at a model like that, you want to think about not just history, mm-hmm. but the future.
And the method that the state has used since the RAM has been adopted to address issues such as you have has not been to go to the system and say, you need to change your cell values, because this was done after an extensive study, but rather to give additional funds for additional purposes that are part of these targeted programs that don't show up in these cell values. The major example of this has been in engineering. The state has said, we have a need, we want to improve or increase the amount of educational resources in engineering and computer science. So the state provided extra money, and the way that the system distributed that money was not by changing cell values, but by saying that here's extra money and we are distributing this in the form of a targeted program, which we really, because of time, haven't discussed in as much detail.
You mentioned the model was based on studies, but has it ever been audited in terms of Oregon's costs? And I think that gets back to your original question, is what are Oregon's costs, and how do they fit into that RAM?
Well, and what is the reality of the RAM, given the budget constraints that all states are facing?
Might be an area for good audit.
Well, and colleagues, we're up against the time wall again, so I'm going to adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 5021 and adjourn this session, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.